Welcome to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. How do you go from losing both parents by the age of 12 to earning degrees from Harvard, Yale, and Columbia to eventually joining President Obama's cabinet? The answer is good teachers. John B. King Jr.'s path to becoming the 10th U.S. Secretary of Education began on the day his mother died. He was young, just 8 years old, but he insisted on going to school that day. He knew he would find comfort in the classroom, not just because he loved school, but also because he loved his teacher, Mr. Osterweil. This hour, we're talking with John King about his new book, Teacher by Teacher, a deeply personal love letter to all the teachers in our lives. John B. King Jr., welcome to All Sides.
Thanks so much. Excited to talk with you.
I wanted to start off with that first impactful teacher that you talk about in your book, Mr. Osterweil. He taught you for several years because the school you went to at the time kept you with the same teacher for more than 1 year. How did Mr. Osterweil impact your life?
I mean, he truly saved my life. As you said, he was my teacher for 3 years, and it was a period when home was incredibly difficult. After my mom passed, I lived with my dad. My dad was struggling with Alzheimer's, and so home was scary and chaotic, and I didn't know why. I didn't know why my father was sad some nights, angry other nights, violent even. And the thing that sustained me was Mr. Osterweil's classroom, because there I could be a kid when I couldn't be a kid at home. We read the New York Times every day. We did productions of A Midsummer Night's Dream, Shakespeare in elementary school. We did a production of Alice in Wonderland. I was the rose in the garden with big red felt petals sticking out of my head. And I remember those things so clearly because school was a place of joy and curiosity and safety that I just didn't have at home.
And he also taught you by showing you. You mentioned these class activities. You also discuss in the book lots of field trips. You say that he wanted knowledge to seep into your pores, which I love that phrase. You also say that he was strict but never mean. Can you tell me about that part of him as a good teacher, the idea of being strict but not mean?
Yeah, you know, when I was a principal, I used to talk with my teachers about being warm strict, right? This idea that you could create a classroom environment that was nurturing, but where the rules and expectations were clear and the routines were clear. And in fact, that kind of structure gives students a sense of stability. So we knew when we were having a class discussion, we had to be attentive, not only to Mr. Osterweil, but to our peers who were speaking. We knew that when we had an assignment, we needed to work on it in earnest. I remember one time we had to cover a country in the New York Times. We had to summarize any article about that country in the New York Times. And I was assigned the Soviet Union. It was during the Cold War, and there were sort of mercifully few articles about the Soviet Union. But then the leader of the Soviet Union passed away. And I remember walking into the classroom and seeing that there was a banner headline that said the leader of the Soviet Union had passed away. And then every article on the front page was about that. And then you know how in the New York Times it says, turn to page A7. I open up A7 and every article across both sides of the paper, every column is about the passing of the leader of the Soviet Union. And I had to summarize all those articles. So that was very demanding. It was rigorous. It took hard work, but it also was very satisfying because we learned so much in his class.
That just, my 8-year-old would never have to turn through the paper. That's just, it's so interesting to hear about you talk about, you know, looking through the paper in the days of the internet and how much you, yes. The That's idea of not being able to find information about the Soviet Union because it wasn't in the New York Times that day. That's so interesting. And it's interesting that you remember that so well. So it's, obviously you were having a very hard time at home that time. Your father had undiagnosed Alzheimer's, so you didn't really know what was going on. So it was where it was chaotic at home, having a strict teacher who ran a fun but organized classroom made your childhood less chaotic, at least half of it, right?
That's absolutely right. You know, I can recall one night my father woke me up 2 a.m, told me it was time to go to school. And I didn't know why. And I remember arguing with my father, being on the staircase in our house, clinging to the banister as my father pulled me on the stairs. And I remember saying to him over and over, no, Daddy, it's not time to go to school. It's not time to go to school. But he was so insistent, and then eventually he just gave up, and we both went back to sleep, and I just went to school the next day, right? And that was kind of how my experience was at home. But the routines of Mr. Osterwald's class and this exposure to a world beyond Canarsie, Brooklyn, going to the Museum of Natural History, going to the ballet, that exposed us to things we otherwise never might have encountered. And that was also really meaningful. Helped me have a sense of hope about the future.
Now, by the time you were in seventh grade, you had officially decided that school was home for you. School took the place of home in your heart. And that's when you had your first Black teacher, Miss D, for social studies. Now, you're Black and Puerto Rican, so what was it like having your first teacher of color?
It was very meaningful. To just see yourself reflected in the classroom. And this is a challenge in the education sector that many students don't see themselves reflected. And you lose something in that. In fact, there's research evidence that shows that African American students who have at least one African American teacher in elementary school are more likely to graduate from high school. There's something very powerful about that role model, that example. Miss D was also just an amazingly engaging and interesting teacher. She was an actress as well as a teacher. And at that point, my father was so sick, and I would often sit in class worrying about what home was going to be like that night, whether my father was okay during the day. But in Miss D's class, I was totally focused on the learning. I describe in the book this project we did an Aztec newscast, and I was the Aztec sportscaster. And in that moment, the most important thing in the world to me was to be the best Aztec sportscaster there had ever been. And that kind of classroom environment is just so important, particularly for young people who are experiencing traumatic events in their life outside of school.
And you also wrote that in Miss D's class, you had your first flicker of Black pride, too. She was teaching you social studies, and she openly challenged the way American society operated. Did she teach you? Was she one of the first people to teach you to question things?
Mr. Osterwald certainly did as well, but I think Miss D was willing to have a more political conversation. We were also more mature by seventh grade. And she liked debate. And, one of the things I describe is that, I was, it was during the Reagan era, I was playing with ideas. And so my classmates knew that you could get Miss D sort of off topic if you engaged her in a discussion about, supply side economics. And so sometimes if people weren't ready for whatever the class activity was for the day, my job was to try to get her engaged in a political debate. Not that she would try to indoctrinate us, but she would ask questions and try to probe and try to deepen our understanding. And she liked talking about current events. And that was also really wonderful for us.
Yeah, I love that part of the book because you were saying that you could avoid a pop quiz if you knew it was coming by raising your hand and saying, "Can you explain taxes to me?" This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurovich, and we're talking today with John B. King Jr., former U.S. Secretary of Education and the author of the new book, Teacher by Teacher. I do want to skip ahead a little. You had some conflicts in high school. You were even kicked out of a New England boarding school that you attended. So, how in the world did you end up at Harvard after that?
School was always so important to me, and academics were always so important to me. So I always had good grades, and I was always excited about what I was learning. But in high school, I was really angry. My dad passed when I was 12. I lived with different family members. There was a lot of tumult in my life, and I went to boarding school thinking that that would be an escape from that. But actually, it was very isolating. I was very out of place, as a kid from Brooklyn in this very elite, fancy New England boarding school where there wasn't a lot of diversity at the time. And I really struggled with the rules. I was angry at adults. I didn't like adults telling me what to do. I'd kind of been on my own since I was 8. I wasn't used to having rules. And so even though I did well in the academics, I struggled with the rules. I got kicked out and I went to live with my aunt and uncle. And that was a really pivotal point in my life. And the book is about teachers, but it's also about the people who are mentors and who take on sort of a teacher role. And my uncle Hal, who's a Tuskegee Airman, ran a tight ship in his house. And really pushed me to take ownership of my life going forward. I remember a conversation where he said to me, neither you nor I can do anything about the things that have happened to you in your life, but you have to decide what kind of man you want to be, what kind of life you want to have. And that was really a turning point for me. And I was given a second chance, really, by teachers and a school counselor at a high school in New Jersey, and got things together and had to write two essays for the college applications, the regular essay and the why'd you get kicked out essay. Harvard decided to give me a shot, and I had a wonderful experience there. I'm very grateful.
Yes, you talk about it's not just teachers in your life who actually are in the teaching profession, but like a lot of different people in your life became teachers to you, teachers, mentors, your aunt and uncle, also some friends throughout your life became kind of influential people in your life who can be, someone even your same age can be a teacher for you. And while at Harvard, you met someone who became a lifelong friend. And this stuck out to me in the book because you met Eric Dawson, who happens to be from Columbus. So I had to ask you about this connection because I'm sitting right here in Columbus. Can you tell me what you and Eric were able to accomplish together at Harvard?
Sure. So Eric and I met freshman year. We both kind of stumbled into getting involved with the Phillips Brooks House, which is the public service organization at Harvard. We were both involved in a program called Peace Games, which was about teaching conflict resolution in schools. And through that work, we got to know each other, volunteering, supporting other volunteers who were teaching in schools. And we decided to run a summer program together, the Mission Hill Summer Program, a summer program where Harvard undergraduates would live for the summer in a public housing development in Boston, an incredibly troubled housing development. At the time, it was the largest open air crack market in New England. Serious issues of addiction and crime and violence in the community. And we lived there and we ran this summer camp for kids, and it was a very intense experience. And we really bonded through that and became best friends. And he I think similar to me, in some ways felt a little out of place at Harvard initially. But we found our place through public service, and we both ended up dedicating our careers to education.
Yeah, and I had to mention him since he's from Columbus. The fellow Buckeye connection had to be brought up in this interview.
Absolutely,
Yeah.
absolutely. And his family is still there. His family
Oh
is still
yes,
in
well, hi to
Columbus.
Eric's family. You graduated from Harvard with a Bachelor of Arts degree with a concentration in government. But after your experience working with those kids in the Peace Games work that you did, you had a conviction of what you wanted to do with your life. You could have done anything, but you decided that you wanted to be a teacher. So, looking back now, is that still a profound moment for you when you made that decision? You have this Harvard degree and you're like, what do I want to do with my life? I want to teach.
Yeah, so it really came down to finding so much satisfaction in trying to do for other young people, at least in some small way, what teachers had done for me. I just loved that spark of academic engagement that you see in the classroom. I love the relationship that you can build with students as a teacher. Unfortunately, there are some folks, certainly, who discouraged me from choosing teaching. And I think that's a real problem in American culture, that we don't sufficiently value and lift up the teaching profession. But I also had this whole community of friends like Eric through the Phillips Brooks House, through the public service work, who also were choosing careers in public service, a number of teachers. And so that was an important support network. And it's really shaped my whole life through various roles in education. It's always for me been about trying to create spaces for other young people, particularly young people facing challenges that feel like Mr. Osterweil's classroom, Ms. D's classroom.
This is All Sides with Amy Juravich. We're talking with former U.S. Secretary of Education John B. King Jr. about his new book, Teacher by Teacher. And coming up, we're going to talk about going from teaching to creating a school from scratch. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Juravich. Former U.S. Secretary of Education John B. King Jr. lost both parents by age 12, was expelled from high school as well, but he went on to get degrees from Harvard, Yale, and Columbia. The son of a teacher and a guidance counselor went on to become the education commissioner for New York State before eventually joining President Obama's cabinet as an education secretary. And he would be the first to tell you that none of that would have happened if it wasn't for some really great teachers who truly shaped his life. We're talking with John King about his new book, Teacher by Teacher. John, thanks again for being here on All Sides.
Thanks so much.
So you spent some time teaching, including a formative teaching experience in Puerto Rico, and you learned that even going to Harvard and going to school to learn to be a teacher, nothing prepares you and nothing makes you a teaching expert except jumping headfirst and learning on the job. So every time you meet a young teacher, do you think about those early days for you?
Oh, definitely. You know, and people sometimes ask me, what's the hardest job you've had? And I think I'm going to say, being in the president's cabinet or being a state education commissioner, hardest job I've ever had was first year teaching. It just takes so much to figure out how to create the right classroom environment, how to plan all your lessons for the first time. That was a very intense experience. So I always think about first year teachers as needing a lot of our support and cheer and gift cards, whatever we could do to help them make it through that first year.
I'm married to a teacher who's in his 20th year, but I remember those first couple of years, and it's definitely different. And you definitely have to learn along the way, but it's also interesting because every year is different.
Yes, definitely. And the kids are different each year, right? And that's part of the fun of it. You build this new set of relationships, and then you get to watch the students grow over time.
Now, you write that you learned in this experience teaching that teaching is more than just conveying information with students, it is connecting with them. Can you tell us the story about how you turned, instead of lecturing to students, you made it more interactive? Can you tell the story about whenever you basically dressed up as Fidel Castro to teach the kids about Cuba?
Yeah. You know, I was very fortunate to have a great cooperating teacher when I was student teaching, Harry Street. And
Oh, you have to
one
say
of
who he is, you know.
he is Meryl Streep's brother,
Yeah.
but
Yeah, there you go.
and just a lifelong a New York City public school teacher, phenomenal teacher, dancer. And so he was observing me in one of my first lessons in his classroom, as a student teacher. And I had planned this really elaborate lesson, and I thought it was going to be great. And it was terrible. The students were totally bored. And, I had all these things. I had visuals, I had primary source documents, from the time that students could look at it. It was elaborate. But what Harry very gently pointed out was that I had planned the lesson around what I was doing as the teacher at the front, rather than planning the lesson around what the students were doing. And the truth is, in that lesson, the students were just sitting and listening for 45 minutes, 50 minutes. So it didn't go well. And so he said to me, you just have to think about it from the student perspective. And that really was such a powerful moment in my whole career in thinking about teaching. So I later described doing this lesson where I came into class dressed as Fidel Castro. I had a cigar and military fatigues, and I just interacted with the students in the role of Fidel Castro, and the students loved it. We had this great conversation about Cuba and its evolution and the challenges of the communist period in Cuba and human rights violations and all those kinds of things. And the students were eager to ask questions, and it really was a reminder for me that so much of teaching is about finding that spark of engagement. And if you can get that spark of engagement, then students are like sponges and they will soak up so much great learning.
Now, because you always seem to be looking for a challenge, at the young age of 24, you ended up opening a charter school in Boston, one of the first charter schools in all of Massachusetts, called Roxbury Prep. Can you tell me about your search for the ideal school and curriculum at the young age of 24?
Yeah. You know, a lot of it was driven by my early teaching experience, just feeling like schools were not necessarily organized to provide teachers with the level of professional support and growth that I really was hungry for. And so we organized Roxbury Prep around the idea that we were going to bet on teacher development. So, for example, teachers would come for 3.5 weeks before the school year would even start to work on curriculum development, to look at student work together, to plan the year. We organized our school day. We had extended school day, a couple hours more of instruction time than the other local schools. But on Fridays, we would end at the same time as the other local schools so that teachers would have 2, 2.5 hours of dedicated professional development time to meet in teams, to talk about individual student needs, to look at video of instruction and give each other feedback. And we tried to create a culture where the curriculum was academically rigorous and really effective and moving students who were coming to us academically behind, not only up to grade level, but making them absolutely competitive with the top schools in the state. But also an environment where teachers felt a part of a professional learning community. And that was really wonderful. The school became the highest performing urban middle school in the state. We had just such a tight-knit faculty that loved being creative together. And I describe in the book some of the fun, creative lessons that teachers did. We also were very attentive to students' character development and trying to help students grow into good people. And that was also very satisfying.
I also thought it was interesting the piece where you wanted to grab the kids and get them to appreciate school in middle school, because you found that when if it came, if you if they didn't figure it out before, if they figured it out before high school, they were more likely to graduate and move on. You had to grab them in middle school, right?
100%. And I learned that from a student. One of my students when I was teaching high school, Ricardo, I taught him in 10th grade. He really struggled. He barely passed the class with like a 59.5 rounded to a 60. And he, was the kind of kid you might think he wasn't paying any attention, but then he'd have this powerful insight or observation. But he just didn't work very hard. And he would come at the end of the quarter with this big stack of papers, trying to make up all the homework assignments for the whole quarter all at once. But I had Ricardo again in 11th grade, and we were doing a paper on the Great Migration and a Harlem Renaissance. And he chose to write his paper about Marcus Garvey. And he got so passionate about this paper and was doing multiple drafts and really had something he wanted to say about Marcus Garvey. And one night we were talking about this after school, and he said to me, "You know, Mr. King, I wish I'd known in ninth grade the things I know now about how to be a student. You know, I'm in 10th grade math. I've really struggled with my grades. I don't know if I'll be able to get to one of the colleges that I'd want to go to. And I just, now I get it. I get what it takes to be a successful student. I just didn't as a ninth grader." And that moment really crystallized for me the desire to move to the middle school level, because I thought you could set some of those habits early so that students would come into high school really on track for college success.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and I'm Amy Jurevich. We're talking today with John B. King Jr., former U.S. Secretary of Education and author of the new book, Teacher by Teacher. And listeners, I would love for you to join the show by telling us the story of a teacher that impacted your life for the better. If you can join us, you can call 614-292-8513, or you can send us an email with your story of a teacher that impacted you to allsides@wosu.org. But we'd love for you to call in and tell a story, 614-292-8513. So eventually, your time running Roxbury Prep led you to becoming the first Black and first Puerto Rican Education Commissioner of New York State. How was that transition from on-the-ground teaching, being an administrator, being in a school daily, to politics?
And it was both exciting because New York is huge, and the opportunity for scale impact was tremendous. But it also was very daunting and a real adjustment, because the politics are very different from the day-to-day of schools. I really went into it thinking that doing policy work, and I was first deputy commissioner and then commissioner. I thought doing policy work, if you had the right facts and the right data and the right evidence that something was good for kids, everything else would take care of itself. But that's not really how politics works. A lot of it is about messaging, a lot of it is about relationships. And I really had to learn that over time. I think over my career, from being commissioner to my time as secretary, to my work now, leading the higher education system of New York, the State University of New York, I've learned a lot about how to navigate in a political environment, still to advance that goal of serving students better, but more conscious of the multiple stakeholders that play a role in politics.
And if you didn't have enough politics in New York, then in 2014, Arne Duncan, President Obama's Secretary of Education, called you and asked you to be his deputy. After Arne stepped down, you were promoted to become the 10th U.S. Secretary of Education, which you in the book called the honor of a lifetime. When you look back at those years in Washington, what stands out the most for you?
Two things. One is it was amazing to work for President Obama. Just so thoughtful, such a person of integrity. And people can have different views about individual policies, but I think everyone across the political spectrum would agree that President Obama approached the role with dignity, with integrity, and really tried to do the best he thought he could to try to help Americans improve their day-to-day lives. And so that was incredibly just personally satisfying. I think a lot, as a leader, about lessons I learned from President Obama. The second thing I would say is I was blessed during my time in Washington to work on some significant policies that made a difference in people's lives, and that was incredibly satisfying. I tell the story in the book of one of our initiatives through the president's My Brother's Keeper initiative, which was focused on boys and young men of color and the gaps they face. But the idea was, if you tried to implement policies that would address the challenges for the populations that often have the most challenged outcomes, you'd actually benefit everybody. And one of the initiatives that we launched was something called Second Chance Pell, where we tried to correct a policy mistake of the mid-90s, where access to Pell Grants, federal support for higher education, was banned for folks who are incarcerated. It's terrible public policy because 95% of the people in prison are coming home. We are all better off if they have an opportunity to gain skills and come home better prepared to be successful on the outside. But that was banned in the mid-90s. Many programs in prisons closed, and we wanted to fix that. So we launched a pilot project called Second Chance Pell, allowing 65 colleges and universities to use Pell Grants for students who are incarcerated. So inspiring. You really see the transformative impact of education. Folks who never felt a relationship with a teacher now have that with a college faculty member. Folks who never thought they could find meaningful employment that was legal now have a path to a good job when they come home. And I love that work. And after the administration, when I was leading a civil rights organization, I was part of an effort to change the law. And we ultimately used that pilot project to make the case for changing the law and restoring Pell Grant access for all folks who are incarcerated. And we're better for it and safer for it.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking with John King, author of the new book, Teacher by Teacher. And I want to have Catherine join us. Catherine from Columbus, can you tell us your story that you wanted to share?
Oh, hi. Thanks. Thank you very much for the opportunity. Yeah, I have been very fortunate with the education I was provided. I was in a Montessori school at age 7. And I had become keenly aware just of, you know, there were a lot of different types of students that my background hadn't exposed me to yet. And one day our teacher decided to do a Seder supper for us, which is part of Judaism. And then at the time I had become, you know, somewhat aware that, you know, so many different religions in the world. And I started asking my friends if they were Jewish or Catholic, not knowing there were other religions. And when she did this ceremony, and I saw all the other students and their faces reacting in different ways to this tradition, it opened my eyes to how other people see the world. And I've carried that example since age 7 with me, and that in conversations and how I interact in jobs, and that I try to see how their faith world impacts how they relate to other people and how I can relate to them myself. I went on to college. I did become a double major. One of them was religious studies. I met up with that teacher many years after college. We just met up, talked for a bit, and she told me, when I told her what I had done and how I felt that it impacted me, which she was so pleased to hear the story, and she told me, I finally got to one of you. And I think it's important to come back to teachers and let them know that. In a similar vein, I have a friend who is a teacher in the Columbus public school system. His name is Stephen. I think that's probably as much as I could say. Mm-hmm. The extent that I see him reaching out on his own time to his students to expose them to new ideas or experiences, getting them into colleges or telling them what they can do with their futures. He has students coming back to him now 10 years later. He's been doing it for about 10 years now. And he's a part of their lives, and he has helped them move on to better things and realize what they can do. So
well,
I'm really glad I had this opportunity to listen to the phone call and the book, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Catherine. Thank you so much for those two stories. Yeah. So John King, I mean, Catherine had a lot in there, but, you know, teachers can expose you to things you never knew, and it's amazing what can stick with you from the age of 7.
Absolutely. And I love that Catherine was able to go back to the teacher to let them know. And I hope, you know, one of the things that the book helped galvanize is people going back to those teachers who made a difference for them and just letting them know and sharing with them, you know, those memories from the classroom. I've been blessed to be able to spend time with Mr. Osterweil, just to let him know. You know, he didn't know all the things that were happening at home for me, but he made school this amazing place. And to be able to express gratitude around that is fantastic. The other thing, Catherine's emphasis on teachers exposing students to really diversity, right? Knowing that there are these different faiths, different cultural traditions. That's so important. And I know that's a complicated subject in today's politics. But the truth is, America is a place of many different faiths and cultural traditions, and we ought to celebrate that as a strength. And teachers can be so powerful in helping students learn to navigate across lines of difference.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich. We're talking with John B. King Jr. today, author of Teacher by Teacher. And listeners, I'd love for you to join the show by telling us a story of a teacher who impacted your life for the better. 614-292-8513, or send us an email with your story at allsides@wosu.org. And we'll be back in just a moment. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY. You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. This hour, we're talking with former U.S. Secretary of Education John B. King Jr. about his powerful memoir, Teacher by Teacher. In it, John writes about how dedicated educators transformed his life. He says that school and his teachers saved his life after losing both of his parents by the age of 12. He writes about the ideal school and curriculum, one that reshapes America's education system to offer that same lifeline to every student. John King, thanks again for being with us this hour.
Thanks for that opportunity.
Now, you were the 10th U.S. Secretary of Education. We're now on our 13th U.S. Secretary of Education, Linda McMahon, McMahon, and she's working with the Trump administration to dismantle the department. I wanted to get your thoughts on the current state and the potential future for the U.S. Department of Education.
Look, I'm very distressed about what the administration is doing. The department has such important functions, you know, and the way I think about it is sort of four core things the department does. One, the department gets resources to vulnerable students. The Title I program that provides resources to schools serving low-income students, Individuals with Disabilities Education Act funding that provides services for students with disabilities. Two, the department manages the federal financial aid system, Pell Grants that help low-income students access college, the federal student loan program that's so important for low and middle-income Americans getting higher education. Three, the department enforces civil rights. It's where you go if you've experienced discrimination on the basis of race or sex or disability. Last year, the department got more than 20,000 complaints, many from families whose children weren't getting the services they're entitled to. And then the fourth area that's really important is data, research, transparency, right? Making sure we know where we're doing well so we can put a spotlight there, but also where we're struggling so that we can intervene. There are now half as many people working at the department as there were on January 20th. I am worried about all four of those areas of work for the department. My hope is that Congress will step up here. The department can't be dismantled without Congress. And so I hope we will see Congress in a bipartisan way stand up for the idea that education is a national imperative.
I would like to move back to another caller who's going to tell us about a teacher. Julianne in Reynoldsburg, go ahead and tell us your story.
Hi. I grew up in an urban school. Each grade had at least two classes and sometimes three for each class. The fourth grade teacher was always given the smallest class at the beginning of the year because any student transferring into the school was moved into her class if they were fourth grade. And it wasn't unusual to stop by after junior high or high school and not be the only former student visiting. And she said at one time it was so easy to teach the kids because the first thing you did is love them.
Well, thank you so much for telling that story, Julianne. Yeah, I mean, that's wonderful. The first thing you do is love them. Yep.
I love that. You know, there's a saying that kids don't care what you know until they know that you care. And I think that message that this is a classroom where I care about you is so powerful. There was, you know, research that showed a huge difference in how students responded to feedback from teachers. And the study looked at two types of feedback. In one case, the teacher gave a bunch of comments on the paper and told students what they needed to fix. In the other case, the teachers gave those same comments, but they also wrote, I believe in you. I know that you can make this paper better. I know that you can do an excellent job. And the latter, the feedback that came with that message of love and support actually resulted in more students turning in rewrites of the paper and improve student outcomes. And I thought that study was a very useful illustration of this idea that part of what a teacher is doing is signaling to students their personal commitment to their success and well-being.
And now we have, we also have Paul from Columbus. Paul, do you want to tell us your story?
I'm also from Brooklyn, and I went to PSA in the Heights, in Brooklyn Heights, and I was a very bad, bad, bad child. And my fourth grade, like the other call, but Mrs. Nicodemus, she washed my mouth out with soap. And this was a fairly common, I mean, it wasn't horribly common, but I remember, and she took me aside, she said, I didn't do that because I don't like you. She says, I really love you, and I like you, and I think you're great. I think your potential is unlimited, but if you're going, you're going to run into a wall. And I did run into a wall, even though I listened to her a little. She always helped me, but I just, it was, my friends were louder than her voice. But I always remember her, and I was a bad teenager. I was sent to detention facility, a juvenile detention until 18. But she said a course. She said words that I never, ever forgot. And she really was a great little short, wonderful lady. And I appreciate her.
All right. Well, thank you so much for telling that story, Paul. Yeah. In the description that they wrote for me about Paul, it was like he had a teacher who finally got him. Yeah.
Well, sometimes, you know, as a teacher, you have to plant that seed. Sometimes it takes a long time. Sounds like for Paul, it took a while for that seed to grow and for that message to sink in about what he needed to do to get on the right path. But, you know, what teachers do is so memorable. I remember when my father passed, at his wake, a man came up to me. My father passed, he was almost 80. And the man who came up to me was probably in his 50s, maybe 60s. And he came up to me. My father had been his teacher. He had not seen him in decades, but he saw the obituary and wanted to come to the wake just to tell me what a big difference my father made in his life. And that always stuck with me that, you know, it mattered to him so much. I'm sure he wished he could tell my father rather than me, but it mattered to him so much to convey that difference my father had made in his life. And I, you know, that's the role teachers play.
Well, I would like to talk about one of my influential teachers. Jan Phillips was my third grade teacher at McKee Elementary. My family had moved and I had switched schools, and I was painfully shy and a complete nervous wreck about this transition. And Mrs. Phillips took me under her wing. She picked me to lead the Pledge of Allegiance and write spelling words on the board. And she did this to help my new classmates notice me, but it also gave me confidence. And then she sat me at a table with two of the nicest girls in the class. And I'm happy to say that they're still two of my best friends 30 years later. So my younger sister and my younger brother both had Mrs. Phillips, too. And my mom still exchanges Christmas cards with her. And so, Mrs. Phillips, thank you.
I love that. I love that. I hope she hears this.
Yes. is it amazing how a good teacher just knows when a kid needs a boost? You were a teacher. Could you tell if you look out into a classroom and see a sea of 24 faces staring at you? Can you pick the one that you're like, I need to talk to them?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Especially because, you know, you get into a certain rhythm with your students you know, you can tell when they're out of sorts, and those small interventions, and sometimes it's just a word, it's an activity, it's a note of encouragement, can really shift the mood for a student and help them reconnect. And one of the things I worry about is because we organize our schools in this country in a way that concentrates the students who are in poverty, who face the greatest challenges, in a subset of schools, and then the way we fund our schools, we under-resource those schools. You end up with a situation where a single teacher can look out at a classroom of 25, 30 students, and more than half of them, sometimes more than three quarters of them, are in extraordinarily difficult circumstances. Either because their families are struggling with food insecurity, housing insecurity, there's violence and crime in the community. And that can be so overwhelming because as a teacher, you want to take care of every student. But when there are so many students who are struggling in that way, and if there aren't enough counselors in the school to provide additional support, that can really overwhelm teachers. And so I do think when we think about policy questions, how do we ensure that teachers have the support, the space, and that we organize our schools in a way where teachers can do that kind of intervention that you're describing that really is critical for students' success.
Now, you mentioned funding. There's been a lot of controversy in Ohio over school funding. Ohio schools are funded in part by state money, but also by property taxes. The funding plan has been found unconstitutional more than once. But trying to change it is something that no one can agree upon. In your work around the country at the federal level, what is the best way to fund a school? Like, who is doing it right?
I wish I could point to a state that was getting it right. There certainly are states, I think about Massachusetts, which is one of our highest performing states, that have really done a lot of work to bring up the floor, if you will, mm-hmm. to ensure that even though there are different levels of resources community to community, that the base is sufficient to provide a quality education. But even in Massachusetts, there are still disparities. There's still a lot of work to do to make sure that the highest need students are getting the full range of opportunities like AP classes and extracurriculars and so forth. I do think there are some states that are organized in counties, and that helps because in a county, you have a little bit more socioeconomic variety. And so the tax base is broader and you can sometimes subsidize the higher needs parts of the county with resources from the more affluent parts of the county. I certainly saw that when my kids were in Maryland schools. But, you know, as a country, I think we don't have a culture that says, as it should, our democracy and our economy depend on every young person having access to the full range of opportunities. And I hope we can get there again, and I hope we can get there in a bipartisan way.
Well, we're running out of time, but I wanted to end with saying that right now you are the chancellor for the State University of New York, the SUNY system. So you've now served at every level of education that I can think of, unless you're planning to teach at preschool before you retire. Is it in your plans?
No. I always tell my wife who taught kindergarten that visiting her classroom for an hour was the most tiring day of teaching I ever spent. The little ones need a lot, and that's I'm definitely more targeted towards the older students.
Well, I want to wish you good luck with the book. It's wonderful. And thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. Great talking with you.
John B. King, Jr., former U.S. Secretary of Education and author of the new book, Teacher by Teacher. Thank you again for your time.
Thank you.
And this has been All Sides. I'm Amy Jurevich. This is 89.7 NPR News.